Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
William Nunez's documentary film begins with the erratic billionaire Howard Hughes ensconced in a hotel room watching the same movie over and over and over again. It was an historical epic called The Conqueror from 1956. John Wayne played the Mongol warrior Genghis Khan. Nunez told us it was one of the films Hughes made in his brief stint as a mogul, and it was widely considered terrible. But no one really understood Hughes's fixation.
He was very nomadic towards the end of his life. He lived in Las Vegas primarily, but he was also living in Acapulco. He was also living in the Bahamas. And for a brief period, he lived in London, strangely enough. He would just take over penthouse suites of hotels in each of these locations. And at that time, his OCD was really starting to take hold in his phobias. And he would sit there watching movies. He would have headphones on that were created for him because he had lost his hearing from all the testing he did with aviation back in the 1940s. And he was also, you know, racked with a lot of medication because when he crashed in Beverly Hills, I think that was kind of the tipping point in his kind of descent into this paranoid persona, you know, letting his hair grow, fingernails, etc. So there he is in London, just sitting there on a chair with a regular movie projector of the 1970s and one of those fold-out projector screens. And he would just watch this movie, The Conqueror, over and over again. Rewind it. Play it.
Would a Mongol dare touch Kumlek's daughter?
You know ill the son of Yesugai.
An insolent pig.
Rewind it. Play it.
There are moments for wisdom, Jamuga, then I listen to you. And there are moments for action, then I listen to my blood.
And who knows what he was searching for, but he was searching for something. It was supposed to be his masterpiece, and somehow things just went terribly wrong.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So in his documentary, William Nunez makes a case that Hughes' obsession over The Conqueror might be guilt. Someone had suggested the area outside St. George could double for the Gobi Desert, so the film was shot there at a time when the U.S. government was testing nuclear bombs some 130 miles away in the Nevada desert. The documentary is doing two things. It tells the story of the making of The Conqueror, but it also explores the connection between those tests and how nearly half the cast and crew, including the stars John Wayne and Susan Hayward, developed cancer. It's also about the residents of St. George, their involvement in the making of this gloriously terrible film, and the tragic affliction they shared with the crew. Nunez's film is The Conqueror, Hollywood Fallout. It's the latest in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to be screening the film tonight at the downtown Salt Lake City Library. We'll have some details here in a moment. We were joined by Nunez and the producer Douglas Waller. Nunez says the fallout part of the story wasn't in their original plan.
It all started really about just doing a movie about the making of this horrible movie. And we decided, Doug and I decided to do it prior to even seeing the movie all the way through. But it was always something fascinating. And I think Doug can speak to it. I think Doug knew about this movie through your mom, was it?
Yeah, my mom actually was sort of into show business. She was a singer, and she mentioned it to me around 1980, I would say, and just talked about it. So I was aware of what was going on. And like, I was a fan of John Wayne and movies and all that. and I would get books about John Wayne. It would skip right over The Conqueror like it never even happened. It was so bad. You know, The Conqueror, the movie, was just so mysterious and elusive and just sort of this myth that I couldn't understand why it was not really covered well, and you couldn't get a copy of it anywhere. So when William mentioned to me, he said, hey, Doug, you know, there's this idea. And I said, yeah, I've heard of it. And it actually took me 24 hours to think about it. And then I decided, you know, all the different angles, Howard Hughes, the bad film itself, the downwinders, the cast and crew dying in such high numbers from cancer, just was a multifaceted story that just has so many layers, and it just becomes really fascinating.
Let's talk about what's going on in cinema that you explore in the film. This is in the 1950s. And this helps us understand what The Conqueror or Howard Hughes may have been going for, at least in part. This was the era, explain this for us. This was the era when you started to see a lot of these really epic films.
Behold his mighty hand!
In the early 50s, studios were trying to create these larger-than-life epics.
Here is all the sweep and spectacle.
The spectacle, the color, the excitement, the human drama.
Yes, and a whole new world of entertainment wonders.
Well, in the 50s, television made the film industry very nervous.
They were very, very conscious of having to counteract that idea that they were competing with little images in a little box in black and white at home. So you had to have splashy color, and you had to have things that were big and felt important.
The motion picture, unforgettable for its spectacle and scope.
Television was such a big threat to Hollywood at that time, much like streaming is now. Yeah. So I thought that was an interesting play as well, that like these times aren't dissimilar. That's why I touch upon it in the beginning of the movie. And I think that was a big process. They were experimenting with different kind of scopes of film, you know, so there was that VistaVision, 3D, all these kind of different ways of projecting and presenting a motion picture to try and get audiences to come in, because television was so prevalent at that time and more Americans were owning television sets.
The other thing that's going on, of course, is that this was the Cold War. And so there's the specter of competition with, you know, with Russia and the bomb. So what was the influence of this new nuclear era on the, I guess, the cultural mindset of the country and artists and filmmakers?
Culturally, I mean, and historically and politically, I think, you know, obviously we had the McCarthy hearings and the kind of in that aspect of the Cold War. So that was touching upon Hollywood very strongly, and filmmakers were turning on each other. But at the same time, there was this competition with Russia to, you know, create a bigger, more devastating bomb. And, you know, and I think Americans took upon it as their patriotic duty to support this. And they were more than happy and gung-ho to believe what the government was telling them in terms of, you know, we have to beat the Russians because they can invade and take our way of life. Because it wasn't just them, you know, there was never any chance of them invading us and all of a sudden there's Russians here. But it's kind of the way of life, the type of government, different social systems, right? So again, that was another aspect of the documentary that attracted me as well in terms of research and going, wow, these things are happening now. So I think at the end, you know, I think people can really relate to this documentary. I hope so, because nothing really has changed that much. And there, even if you look at some of the headlines when they're talking about atomic testing, if you look at the bottom, they're talking about Iran and they're talking about the Middle East having issues. And you're like, oh, my God, fascinating.
Doug, would you talk a little bit about Howard Hughes's role in the industry, in the film industry? You mentioned in the film that he was determined to shake up the industry. Talk a little bit about in what way. He's eccentric, he's charismatic, he's got a lot of money, but What was he like as a head of a film company or a head of a production company? Like, what's the role he's trying to play here?
Actually, Howard Hughes, I think, never visited the RKO studios in Culver City, and he never actually visited the Conqueror set or during shooting. He would just secretly meet with the directors or John Wayne after midnight in the parking garages of a studio, or his office was up in Samuel Goldwyn Studios for a while. And it's just very bizarre. It's like he owned it, he controlled it, but he didn't go there. Personally, I think a lot of his interest in movie making was so that he could meet the star, the leading actresses, and date them. He certainly did that with Susan Hayward. So when he was watching it daily in his Las Vegas hotel room on the top floor, you know, he's looking at Susan Hayward every day. So maybe that was a little bit a part of it too. Maybe he thought it was such a great film. Why didn't other people think it was so great? Where did he go wrong?
Yeah.
But, you know, he was a mogul, and he wanted to be he wanted to dominate that industry. And, he would hire these actresses and put his girlfriends in the starring roles. So it was just sort of like almost a toy for him in a way. But I think he wanted to prove himself, and I think he kind of unfortunately failed a little bit. Like, look at this Spruce Goose, that biggest airplane ever flown. And that was ultimately a failure. So he was striving for something but couldn't quite reach it, I think.
Hmm. What was his interest in Genghis Khan? That was another really interesting part of the story.
I think it's not different than himself, right? He probably saw himself in Genghis Khan, saw himself as someone who can conquer everything. He conquered Hollywood starlets. He conquered aviation. He conquered the movie industry. I can do it all. And here's the perfect representation of it.
Well, I think it's also really interesting. Two characters I'll mention, important players in the story: Dick Powell, who's the director, Oscar Millard, the screenwriter. Dick Powell has to meet apparently with Howard Hughes, you say in the documentary, in the back of a limousine to plan out the production elements. He has this kind of obsession with secrecy. It's very cloak and dagger. Would you talk a little bit about, I guess, the role? I guess I'll put it this way: the role of Hughes's, you know, mental illness in the way that film was created and produced.
I think so. And like, I think that probably is mental illness and his physical debilitation.
Yeah.
And then his dependence on, you know, medication was due to that plane crash in the 40s in Beverly Hills. And his paranoia just got, you know, he believed that the government was out to get him. They were doing surveillance. Other movie moguls were out to get him. So he would meet people in the oddest places. So yes, he would meet Dick Powell at 2 a.m. in a parking garage.
That's William Nunez. He directed The Conqueror, Hollywood Fallout. We also have with us the producer, Douglas Waller. We're going to be screening the film tonight at the City Library in Salt Lake. We're going to begin a little earlier. We're going to start at 6:30. You can get details at RadioWest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling the latest film in our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Tonight at the City Library in Salt Lake City, we're going to be screening William Nunez's documentary, The Conqueror, Hollywood Fallout. This is about the making of one of the worst movies ever, The Conqueror from 1956. That's part of it. But the other part is that this film was shot downwind of the nuclear test site in the Nevada desert. We have with us the director, William Nunez, and the producer, Douglas Waller. One of the things you mentioned in the documentary is we hear in the film Oscar Millard, the screenmaker, a reading from Oscar Millard talking about his approach to the script for The Conqueror. And Millard says he wanted to write it in this kind of stylized form of English.
Carried away, I decided to write the screenplay in stylized, slightly archaic English. Mindful of the fact that my story was nothing more than a tarted-up Western, I thought this would give it a certain cachet, and I left no lily unpainted.
When him and Hughes were talking about the project and with Powell, because at the end of the day, Howard Hughes basically told Dick Powell, you're the producer, go get me a big hit, go make me a big hit, and kind of left him there, like kind of hanging, you know. He did get whatever he wanted, Dick Powell, to be sure. You know, the road that goes through Snow Canyon Park in St. George was built by Howard Hughes so they can bring in all the trucks and the crew and the company. But going back to Oscar Millard, I think they wanted to get Marlon Brando, and in their kind of narrow-mindedness, wrote it as if it was Shakespearean.
Yeah.
And Marlon Brando, when he turned it down, and the irony is he turned it down to do a movie called Tea House of an August Moon, which he played a Japanese, which again was totally cultural appropriate. But I guess in his defense, that was the hot play on Broadway at the time. It even won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
So he picked that project over The Conqueror. So you would think they would revise the script for the next actor. And they tried Yul Brynner and a few others. But when John Wayne walked into Dick Powell's office, because they were friends, and saw The Conqueror on his desk, he said, I'll do this. And they were like, you sure? Yeah. And then, of course, Howard Hughes goes, well, I'll have the biggest movie star, of course. John Wayne didn't really read the script until it was time to shoot and realized the dialogue that Oscar Millard had written is totally, you know, unlistenable.
Yeah, well, the film, former film critic and scholar Michael Medved is in the documentary. He says John Wayne may have read it, but he wasn't sober. Millard is really worried about John Wayne trying to take on his script. How, you know, this icon of American Westerns and this distinctively American, you know, with an American accent. How is he going to handle the stylized dialogue? It's tricky.
Yeah, well, I read the script at the Margaret Herrick Library in Los Angeles, and it's bad.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know he's trying to be kind, and I'm not trying to defend John Wayne here, but at the end of the day, it wouldn't have mattered who the actor was.
Yeah.
It would have been terrible.
Susan Hayward, let's talk about her, the part she plays. She's, again, like Wayne, maybe not his stature necessarily, but one of the big stars of the era. And as I think as the film points out, and you both sort of mentioned, Hughes wanted to work with her so he could probably sleep with her, try anyway. Talk about her part that she plays.
Well, she didn't want to do it. She read the script. She did read the script, and she thought it was awful.
Yeah.
But she owed RKO a movie, and Hughes wanted her. Hughes picked her out specifically and wanted her to do it and threatened to sue her if she didn't. So she had to do it. And, you know, what's interesting is after the movie ended, was wrapped, they all forgot about this movie. It was so inconsequential until they all started getting sick, right? Dick Powell became a big showrunner and had the Zane Grey Theater. He had like four TV shows going on in the late 50s, early 60s. John Wayne's next film is literally probably his greatest, right? The Searchers.
Yeah.
And then Susan Hayward wins an Oscar 2 years later. And then Agnes Moorehead on Bewitched 5 years later. And wow. Pedro Armendariz goes on to continue to do movies. So I think it's interesting that they totally forgot about this film until the connection of the illnesses started creeping through 10 years later.
Yeah. We'll get to that here in a second. I want to come back to the sort of geopolitical part of the story then you tell in the documentary. As you point out in the film, this is the beginning of the Cold War in this country. There's this sense of urgency when the Russians, you know, test a nuclear weapon and then things get really serious. Let's talk about how a test site ends up in Nevada. Talk about that part of the story.
It was really due to cost. They were doing, in the late 40s, they were doing all their testing out in the Pacific by the Marshall Islands. And they were based in Los Alamos, New Mexico. So just to bring all those scientists, the bomb, all those things out to those atolls and detonate those bombs, it was just too much money. They originally wanted to do it in North Carolina near Cape Hatteras for some strange reason. But I think it was mainly because they knew the winds were blowing eastward and it would blow out into the Atlantic. But of course, the people of North Carolina said, no way in hell they were going to do that. So they picked the Nevada test site, you know, what is it, 80 miles northwest of Las Vegas. In, you know, they used eminent domain to get some of the Shoshone tribes off the land, and they started testing there. And it was great because it was, what, a 4 or 5 hour drive to Los Alamos from there, so they could go do the tests and hightail it out of there, even though it was a little working city as well because there were people there all the time as well. But they still maintained their labs in New Mexico, so it was kind of, you know, inexpensive. Yeah. To do those tests.
Doug, how does St. George come up as a setting for this film that plays out in the Gobi Desert? Because let's get to the part where this setting for the film is really close, like 130 miles from this Nevada test site.
Well, it's also an issue of cost. Do you really take your cast and crew to the Gobi Desert to shoot there, you know, halfway around the world, or do you find something near Los Angeles, you know, even though it's several hundred miles from Los Angeles, it's considerably much closer than going halfway around the world. So, you know, there's a lot of exotics geology out there. And somebody was mentioning that they saw the Stone Canyon and it looked similar to the Gobi Desert. And that's why I think that spot was chosen. It actually is a quite spectacular canyon. The rock formations, it's really breathtaking.
William, would you talk a little bit about how the filmmakers, the actors, how do they interact with the locals? This is a really kind of fun part of the film. Susan Hayward's son is in the film, and he mentions they occasionally on Sunday, I think he said, they would go to an LDS church. So what was the relationship like? I mean, they used locals for wranglers and extras and handlers. Talk about that.
It was actually very impressive. You know, the Deseret News in St. George edition, they would publish daily, you know, bulletins about the making of the movie. It was a big deal for them. And it was shot in the summer, so school was out. So they used the local schools there as holding grounds for costumes and the extras and makeup. And then they'd put them on a bus and ship them over to Snow Canyon for the day shooting. And the locals just got to see them around town. You know, of course, John Wayne would go to the only bar that served alcohol in St. George. Of course, that's where you could find him if you wanted to go there.
Right.
And he would get into fights with cowboys, right, with the cowboy ranchers or the stuntmen. So there was some great stories that we heard from Norman Powell, and who was there with Pat Wayne. And they were more, he was more friends with Michael Wayne, who passed away.
Yeah.
And then Dick Powell, unfortunately, passed away right before we were going to do his interview. So we never got those stories on tape, you know, that he was telling me about his time in St. George. But they would hang out at Dick's Cafe, which was a big cafe at the time. It's now the Zion National Bank at the corner there in St. George.
Dick's Cafe, a renowned restaurant in St. George, was not only the chief dining spot, but Dick Hammer catered on location. A lot of the locals were used as security guards, as greensmen, as extras. Just about everyone was needed to be in the film.
They took up all of the hotels, and the whole company from Los Angeles, which was amazing because, you know, that is like a stopover town, isn't it? From Salt Lake to Los Angeles or Las Vegas, or if you're going to Los Angeles, you spend the night, say, in St. George, and then you continue driving back then. So
they all got along. It wasn't like, you know, all these Hollywood people are coming in and invading whatever. I think they all were happy to have them and they were happy to be there. And then Pedro Armendariz called it God's country.
Yeah. One of the things that comes up, of course, in the film, and it's just to remind people, the sets for The Conqueror, of course, there in Snow Canyon and those places, some 135 miles from the test site. They did something like 920, I think it was 920 tests there. And one of the things you mention in the film, we hear from residents, they would have picnics and watch some of this playing out there in the distance, these mushroom clouds. We hear a good bit of that in the documentary. Say something about that.
Yeah, those nuclear blasts were like entertainment. It's like watching fireworks. It's kind of spectacular. Could you imagine if they detonated 900 nuclear bombs in North Carolina, how different the East Coast would be?
Yeah.
I just can't imagine. The way of life back in St. George in the mid-50s was a very different time of the American life. And, you know, they were fascinated by the nuclear weapons. They were helping the United States in the Cold War effort. Unfortunately, the propaganda, I think the government, you know, pretty much said, you know, it's safe. Don't worry about it. But don't let your kids outside.
Yeah.
You know, so in the same sentence, they were contradicting themselves. And, you know, if you look at the tones and the camera work and the sets of The Conqueror, the pilot for Star Trek was filmed in the very same studio with the same, probably with similar crew. So you can actually see a similarity between the pastel colors of the Star Trek series and the look of The Conqueror itself. It sort of was passed down.
You know, in Las Vegas, they would have atomic watch parties. They would all go out with their sunglasses on and have atomic cocktails and drinks and go out there and watch the test right on Fremont Avenue or whatever and watch the test. Lucky for them because the wind was blowing in the opposite way where those people having picnics watching it, it was blowing in their direction. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting comparison.
It's interesting. Doug was mentioning that they, you know, they're saying it's safe, but maybe you shouldn't go to the kids shouldn't have recess this day. You have an actual radio announcement from the Atomic Energy Commission. I think it's from May of 1953, where they're saying, look, there is no danger, but no recess is permitted.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt this program to bring you important news. Due to a change in wind direction, the residue from this morning's atomic detonation is drifting in the direction of St. George. To prevent unnecessary exposure to radiation, it is better to take cover during this period. Parents need not be alarmed about children at school. No recesses outdoors will be permitted. There is no danger. This is simply routine safety procedure.
Isn't that scary to get an announcement like that? And how many people are really listening to the radio at that moment in time, you know? And I found it very interesting that Dirty Harry, as it ended up being called, the Harry test shot was so powerful and so full of radiation, and it fell all on St. George. And then 9 months later, there they are in Snow Canyon filming The Conqueror.
Mm-hmm. There's a moment you include in the film. There's a he grew up in St. George, a man named Kevin Holt. He talks about how his mother would bring him in when these mushroom clouds would appear. She would get him out of it. And he could see, he says, in this moment from the film, or sense the actual heat in that cloud as it passes over.
Yeah, and isn't it, I mean, you would know better than us because you live in Utah, but there are so many valleys, right? And the air or a cloud can stay there for a while, right? So if one of those atomic tests floats over that whole Cedar City, Washington County area, you know, it could possibly stay there, right? With all that fallout coming, and it just stays there because of the climate and the topography and just the airstreams of valleys, which Utah has quite a few.
When did the people of St. George start to realize that it wasn't safe?
Almost immediately, because their sheep were dying.
Yeah. Talk about the way this evolves. The locals are starting to come to the realization that they're being told there's no danger when, in fact, there is. Irma Thomas becomes one of the first, I guess, activists, you could put it that way. She makes an X on the houses on maps. Talk a little bit about this part of the story.
So it began, just like anything else, there is a progression. And what happened, obviously, was every time or every few times a test occurred, the sheep would be deformed, or they would come back burned, or they'd just be dead. And, you know, and the farmers were attributing this to the test. Well, the government sent out people to St. George and said, no, it's that you're terrible farmers. It's cold up in the hills and they're coming back windburned. I mean, they were giving them tons of excuses, and they started suing the government to get compensation for their lost sheep. So that was one way. And of course, they were denied. I mean, they would win in the local courts, and then the government would appeal and it would go to Salt Lake and it would be turned down based on national security or in an appellate court. And then it started with all of a sudden children starting to get leukemia at a much higher rate than the national average, and children started getting sick in the early 60s, late 50s. And then it just started getting into adults. So it was a gradual but steady kind of uptick from animals, children, adults. And they knew that it had to be something that had to do with the atomic test because, frankly, that was clean air back then. They were all agrarian farmers, as it were. It's not the St. George you think of today. And they were just like, how can this be? How can this clean air, this area that doesn't have any industry that can have cancer-causing material, and we're getting higher cancer rates than the average, you know, the national average?
There's a dynamic that you explore in the film that I wanted to ask you about, which is the fact that it's not just a one generation of people that have been affected. There's a multi-generational aspect to all of this. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, I think that was a very important aspect to this whole story, which is cancer is can be genetically traceable. And when I had that doctor and she was talking about, you know, what a lot of people may or may not know is that every woman is born with every egg that she's ever going to have. So it was like Russian roulette at the time of, you know, Claudia Peterson, you know, being born, she was more predisposed to having cancer. And, you know, that the mother, in, you know, took in some of that fallout particle so that maybe one of Claudia's eggs was going to have that genetic trait that would cause cancer. And then, you know, and that's, you know, she's not the only one that happened. There were people being born in the 70s without arms, without other limbs, and just sick and dying at 5 years old, 6 years old at that time, just for those reasons. And I needed to kind of sneak that in there so that to show that this is an ongoing problem, that this stems generationally. It's just not only the people that got sick from the 1950s test, that this is now carried on to other generations.
That's the director, William Nunez. We also have with us producer Douglas Waller. We're talking about their film, The Conqueror, Hollywood Fallout. You can join us for a screening tonight at the Downtown Salt Lake City Library. We're going to get started a little earlier, 6:30. You can get more details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners just like you. To donate, visit KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the 1950s, the eccentric billionaire and wannabe movie mogul Howard Hughes sent a cast and crew of 220 people to St. George, Utah, to shoot a film about the Mongol warrior Genghis Khan, starring John Wayne. This was at the peak of the government's open-air nuclear testing program, and the sets for the film were just 130 miles away. Nearly half of the crew developed cancer, and that's not to mention the thousands of Utah residents who lived downwind from those blasts and who were also afflicted. Today in the program, we're profiling a documentary that explores the connection and the consequences. It's called The Conqueror, Hollywood Fallout. It's the latest in our film series. We're going to be screening it tonight at the City Library in Salt Lake City. We have with us on the program the director, William Nunez, and the producer, Douglas Waller. You mentioned that after they make this completely forgettable film, pretty terrible film, people forget about it. The actors themselves tried to just sort of move on and didn't really think much about it. Then, of course, they, as you say, started to get sick. When does that all start to come together? One of the people you interview in the film is the photojournalist Mark Sennett. He seems, I guess, to start to put it all together.
Yeah, he put it all together through Irma Thomas. So just getting back to your, I didn't answer your question about Irma, my apologies, was basically with the children part, she started seeing that her whole neighborhood was starting to get, the children were starting to get sick and dying of cancer, and she would put an X to everybody. And she started complaining first to the St. George, you know, local councils or whatever, and she was being rebuffed, and they thought she was crazy. And then she started making a bigger stink, but more locally.
Irma Thomas's daughter, Michelle, was a good friend of mine. I spent a lot of time at their house. And Irma had a hand-drawn map of St. George. And she started marking X's on the houses of people that had cancer. And it became very apparent that, like, wait, there's a lot of people dying of cancer. And it was because of Irma Thomas that we really started to think, wow, something's going on here. When Michelle Thomas contracted cancer, I thought, here's her mom trying to prove that the government gave us all cancer, and then her own daughter gets cancer.
So what was interesting is that Mark Sennett, and I think it's a great story that ties the documentary to the both parts of Hollywood and St. George, was that he was commissioned by People magazine to do a short story on Irma Thomas. You know, that here's a woman fighting for the cancer thing. And she's the one that told him about The Conqueror. But by coincidence, he lived next door to Michael Wayne in Toluca Lake, California, and said, do you know this movie, The Conqueror? And she went, yeah, I was there. I got sick. I think my dad died of it or whatever. And that gave the impetus for him to start researching. And him and Michael, and then Karen Jakovich, who co-wrote the article with him for People magazine, they did a study of everyone in the cast and crew and found and made the connection that out of the 220 cast and crew, 91 contracted some form of cancer and 45 passed away.
Well, of course, John Wayne had cancer. Now, there's some question about, at least the question in his mind, certainly, about whether or not it had anything at all to do with the shooting of this film in St. George. He was a patriot, as the film points out. He pointed out, look, I smoked a lot. Susan Hayward smoked a lot. Dick Powell smoked a lot. The people who came down with these cancers, that's what he said it was. Or at least thought it was, said something about that. I guess that was the patriotic response. He was just – do you think he really did believe that?
He believed that there was a connection. Where his patriotic roots came was, well, if I got it, I got it. But, you know, it was because of the testing, but we have to beat the Russians, right? So it's a small price to pay for the Cold War, he was going to take a hit. But people kind of forget that he first got cancer in 1964, so around the time that Agnes Moorehead and Dick Powell and Pedro got sick.
Wow.
And he didn't die of lung cancer. He died of stomach cancer.
Yeah.
So at the end, can you say it was the smoking? You know, I'm sure it didn't help. But he stopped smoking cigarettes after 1964 and then turned to cigars. But Susan Hayward died of many. She had breast cancer, pancreatic cancer. She had liver cancer. She had, at the end, she had brain cancer. And she died of an aneurysm because the weight of all the tumors in her brain was so heavy, it caused her brain to collapse. It was horrific.
You know, there's this moment I don't know who it was in the Pentagon that said it. You reference maybe it was a report, but the sentence, which you use as an epigraph in one of the sort of chapters of the film, please God, don't let us have killed John Wayne.
Well, he was a big icon back then. You know, even when he was dying, Maureen O'Hara went before Congress and Jimmy Carter did a national day of mourning. I mean, you couldn't get two people politically opposite than Jimmy Carter and John Wayne, yet they were very good friends. So what does that tell you about where we are now, right? So back then, they even had conversations and disagree. And when you even think of Hollywood back then, mainly liberal, but, you know, in they abhorred his politics, but they made movies together, you know, and they talk. I mean, Kirk Douglas had great respect for John Wayne, and John Wayne, for him, it doesn't matter. As long as you produce the goods when you're working, that's all that counted, right? So that he was such a national hero and that the People magazine story came out like a few months after, I think caused a major, you know, panic because the magazine article rings true, right, when you connect all the dots. And the thing is, you can never tell why one person gets cancer. But what you study is clusters. So you study the clusters of the children in St. George or the people in Washington County, and then you study the clusters of the people who worked on the Conqueror, and you can make a reasonable assumption that the common denominator was the testing.
Yeah. Doug, do we know what Howard Hughes made of the testing? You mentioned in the documentary he at least reportedly offered Lyndon Johnson $1 million to stop it. It sounds like it's something he would do.
Actually, when the testing went from above ground to below ground, Howard Hughes had a monetary interest. He had a drill bit company, and they produced the drill bits for drilling down for the underground testing. And I think he felt guilty about it. I think he felt that people were dying in St. George and, you know, his cast and crew. It must have been, you know, an important issue to him. It's not so important that he would make that offer of $1 million. But he wasn't successful.
Yeah. William, it brings us back to the story we started with, which was Howard Hughes there in a screening room by himself, watching over and over and over again a print of The Conqueror. And he bought all of those prints you mentioned. He removed it from distribution. It was a terrible film, but it was successful. That was another thing that kind of surprised me. It made money. It didn't make a lot of money, but it made some money. And he took it out of distribution and then watched it over and over and over again. What do you think was going on there? Was that an expression of guilt? Or there's another suggestion that Michael Medved mentions in the film. He says it was just sort of – maybe he was just sort of feasting on the splendor of the magnificence of this film, this epic film that he had created. Like, what do you think that's about?
What a great line he uses, doesn't he? I mean, yeah. he kind of alludes to this attraction because I think it's fascinating that when he sold RKO to Desi Lu for $25 million, he just bought Jet Pilot and The Conqueror back for 13. So Desi Lu got all that Culver City property, the library, the equipment, the sound stages, all that for 12 million. It was great.
Can I point out an irony?
Yes, of course.
At RKO at Culver City, stage 15, where The Conqueror was filmed, they also filmed King Kong and Star Trek there as well. But probably the best, one of the best movies ever made was Citizen Kane by Orson Welles, shot on stage 15. And also The Conqueror was shot there, one of the worst films ever made. And what they have both in common is that Agnes Moorehead was in both of those movies.
Right. Well, this, I guess we could bring up one of the most compelling parts of the film. One of the things that Howard Hughes insisted upon was getting 60 tons of Southern Utah red sand transported to where they did the interior shooting, as you on that set there in Los Angeles that you mentioned. And there's a big question of what happens to the sand, because it was hot. It was, people had tested it. It registered on a Geiger counter.
I mean, I think it's very funny that that they brought all that sand back, but they didn't know. I mean, it made perfect sense to bring in the sand back to match the shots, right? So it made total sense. It was only after everyone passed away and the cancer story became prevalent is that when they made the connection. And, you know, I tried, but it was really difficult because in a PO order, for example, you know, showing, you know, please remove the sand from the lot and put it wherever and truck it to wherever, doesn't exist. Or if it did exist, it would have probably been discarded, destroyed, because back then it would have been so insignificant. Yeah. So I guess the great mystery is, like, where is that sand today? And that's kind of why we ended the documentary with different guesses, because no one seems to know.
Yeah. So the scholar Andrew Kirk says in the film that this story is still relevant. Talk about in what way?
Well, because it wasn't just the people of Southern Utah. I mean, I think when they finally got reparations, when they finally got compensation, rather, for the RICA Act, it only covers 20 counties. Southern Utah, parts of Nevada, parts of Arizona and New Mexico. It doesn't cover northern Utah, right? It doesn't cover northern Nevada or parts of California and Idaho. But the most important part of it is how, you know, there's a reason why it's called the Westerly Winds. And the winds, you know, that radiation blew all over the, you know, continental U.S. and parts of southern Canada. Buffalo got atomic snow. Chicago got atomic snow. Missouri has gotten a lot of fallout and downwind cancers that they are not acknowledged. So it's relevant because radiation has, forget about the political ramifications of wanting to test nuclear weapons again or the threat of nuclear war as seems to be happening. But even now, since radiation has a half-life of 14,000 years, two things for Utah. One is, you know, Salt Lake is drying up a little bit. And are they testing the lake bed for any radiation? And St. George is one of the fastest growing communities in America. And when Doug and I went earlier this summer for a screening of The Conqueror in St. George, when we walked around and drove around, just in the year and a half since we were last there, right, the building and the golf courses and all the new, you know, so they're digging up all that dirt. Are we going to know the ramifications of it immediately? No. But again, like most things, 5 to 10 to 15 years will.
I think with Las Vegas becoming more expensive for real estate, the real estate companies have moved up to St. George, and it looks like billions of dollars worth of townhouses are being built all over the place up there. But when we did the premiere at the theater in St. George, which is a sellout, the moderator asked everybody in the theater, put your hands up, who has never heard of this story before you walked into the theater here? And about half of the people put their hands up.
Wow.
I was really shocked about that, because to me, this is a story that is extremely important, especially if you live in St. George and people are moving in and they just have no idea of what happened in the last 50 or 80 years. I just feel like it's this story of the Conqueror and the nuclear testing and the
the aftermath for the people of St. George and Southern Utah. It truly is one of the great untold American tragedies.
Well, William Nunez, Douglas Waller, thank you both very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
That's Douglas Waller. He's a producer for the documentary The Conqueror, Hollywood Fallout. We also had with us the director, William Nunez. We're going to be screening their film tonight at the City Library in partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're going to get started a little earlier, 6:30. You can get more details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on YouTube, KUER 90.1, on Instagram, at Radio West. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.